Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
This morning I want to welcome back Ivo Vechter, who's a freelance journalist, columnist, and one of the Daily Friend columnists. And he loves this, according to his bio, he loves debunking myths and misconceptions. And today is just one of those days. We are going to debunk myths and misconceptions. And this should get everyone excited because I was taken with an article he wrote for us entitled CBD Products Are a Scam. Ivo, welcome. And this is bound to have everyone very excited, overexcited possibly. And I still would put it in the category of it's about politics because it's about legislation, it's about our views, it's about one of those things that's so big in society and it's controversial. And you and I probably think it shouldn't be controversial, but here we go. Ivo, why are CBD products a scam? Let's start with the increasing legalization of dacha.
Hello, Sarah, and good morning to your listeners. The CBD stands for cannabidiol, right, which is an ingredient, one of 113 chemical ingredients of the cannabis plant. Now, what makes this interesting is that it really comes at a sort of a nexus of alternative health, conspiracy theories about big pharma, conspiracy theories about the state, you know, legalizing drugs, the war on drugs, the politics involved with that. It's right at that magical nexus. And the sellers of CBD products are exploiting this. They are loving it. They're selling their products for insane prices. I saw a CBD body cream that's supposed to be, that actually says magical healing on the label. You know, if you can believe that. It sells for about 500 Rand per 100 milliliter jar. Now, if you compare that with the normal body cream, which sells for about 20 Rand per 100 milliliters, or aqueous cream, which sells for 10 Rand per 100 milliliters, these guys are making an insane amount of money. And then you'll see loads of products, all containing CBD of some description, you know, ointments and edibles and, you know, things that you can... things you can smoke, things with little oils and droplets and spritzes and, you know, you name it. They've got products that contain CBD and that do all sorts of wonderful things for you. The most common claim being that it works for chronic pain, for the treatment of chronic pain. Now, it raises so many interesting questions, you know. The whole thing started, obviously, back in the 60s, probably, with libertarian boomers who said, look, we need to legalize marijuana because it's not that harmful. It's, you know, compared to alcohol, it's probably about similar. It hasn't harmed a generation of hippies, which is debatable. And frankly, it's none of the government's business what we put in our bodies. You know, as long as we don't hurt other people, it should be up to us what we do for recreation. We make choices about pleasure and risk all the time. You know, when you drink a can of soda, you know, that contains sugar, you're making a choice. You're making a conscious choice. It's not good for your health. You know that. But it might be nice on a hot summer's day. So you take these risks. You take risks all the time. When you go, you go outdoor adventuring, you're taking risks. You're taking risks when you eat a large steak. You know that this is, you know, this might have consequences for your heart health or whatever, but you'll do it once in a while anyway. So on that same basis, you can say, look, there's really no problem with marijuana, and people should occasionally be entitled to use it. And governments are coming around to that idea now. So that was an original sort of libertarian impulse, which I largely agree with. You know, I think the war on drugs has been terrible. It's created an underclass of imprisoned people. It's created these black markets that criminal cartels benefit from. It's been remarkably unsuccessful. You know, they're throwing billions and billions at this, and all they've done is they've created a massive government armed force that fights a massive drug cartel force in little proxy wars all around the world. So it hasn't been successful as policy. So as policy, I absolutely think legalization is the right way to go. But now you get the claims of medical marijuana, you know, that this needs to be legalized because it has medical properties. Now, this becomes a lot more dubious. It turns out that for THC, which is the psychoactive ingredient in cannabis, there are only two proven indications for the use of THC. Both are as an appetite stimulant, and one is specifically for wasting in HIV AIDS patients, and the other one is for people undergoing chemotherapy for cancer. You know, you'll know people with cancer undergoing chemotherapy, they don't like eating, they waste away because of it. You know, they suffer with nausea, and THC being an appetite stimulant, which regular smokers will know as the munchies, is indicated for that. And there are, in fact, FDA-approved drugs that isolate the active ingredient and, you know, give you a well-controlled, well-established dosage, so you know exactly how much you're taking. It's isolated, so you're not taking all the other stuff that's in marijuana, which you know, may or may not have negative side effects. But they you know, the pharmaceutical industry is perfectly happy selling you, you know, proper tested drugs for those indications. With CBD, it's different. There's only one indication for which it has been licensed and for which a drug is available, and that is to help in three specific types of epilepsy, help against seizures. All of the other claims seem to be completely spurious. They have not been established in randomized controlled trials. And in fact, this recently came out by a professor, Chris Eccleston, who leads the Center for Pain Research at the University of Bath. And he said that there's no evidence that CBD products reduce chronic pain. Taking them is a waste of money and is potentially harmful to health. Now, the harmful to health claim is not necessarily from the CBD itself, which really seems to do very little. But it's because these tinctures, often you don't know what dose you get. There might be a lot less CBD in it, a lot more. It might also be contaminated with a lot of other chemicals. You know, people just sort of extract this from the plant, and the extraction process might not be up to, you know, pharmaceutical grade standards. So you end up with some sort of cloudy oil of some description that contains all sorts of other things other than CBD. So it could be harmful to your health. But it certainly doesn't work. And you know, that's where I get interested. Now you've got a whole big industry selling people, you know, stuff that frankly doesn't work.
Well, I think what gets to you and me is the fact that it's an industry worth tens of billions of dollars. And very often the users who will defend the industry will defend it at the same time as attacking the pharmaceutical industry as being greedy, as being prepared to, you know, sort of produce anything that they can make money out of, irrespective of the harm it can do to you. The problem I have is not, as I agree with you entirely, people should be entitled to ingest, smoke, whatever they want, provided it doesn't harm other people. And there are two problems here. For me, the one is that the rigorousness of pharmaceutical testing required to put a drug into the market that can be categorized as an efficacious medicine is huge. It usually takes a lot of time, a lot of money. Those costs, to some extent, will have to be recouped. There is a limit to altruism. And if you just look at the insert of almost anything that is registered as a medicine, it has to list dosages. It has to list side effect. It has to warn against the compounds that may go into the medication. Who are the people who may be susceptible to harm because of an underlying or other condition? None of that applies to the CBD industry.
And this is a problem, you know, because cannabis-derived products do have side effects, and some of them can be harmful. Some of the harm depends on mental health conditions, for example. You know, some people say that THC products, for example, help them relax.
Mm-hmm.
Other people who suffer from anxiety say that it actually makes it worse. Mm-hmm. You know, there are many reports of cannabis-induced psychosis,
mm-hmm.
You know, that this causes serious mental health problems, especially with frequent and long-term use. So the notion that this is a harmless substance is really not true. There are documented brain changes, especially in younger people who haven't mm-hmm. got a fully developed prefrontal cortex yet. Changes in cognitive outcomes, pregnancy outcomes. There's some cancers that have been linked to marijuana use. The smoke itself is, of course, very similar to tobacco smoke.
Mm-hmm.
And causes very similar harms. In fact, it's slightly worse than tobacco smoke. Studies have shown that marijuana smoke leads to 5 times the blood level of carbon monoxide, threefold increase in the amount of tar inhaled. Mm-hmm. Okay, you probably smoke a bit less of it than you would smoke cigarettes, you know, which proportionally might make cigarettes more harmful. But they're certainly not harmless.
Mm.
You know, it's certainly not risk-free. The idea, you know, the pothead stereotype of being slow and dull-witted is real,
mm.
you know. So are the symptoms of anxiety, paranoia, and even psychosis that marijuana can cause. So, you know, going around claiming that it's harmless is simply not true.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why studies of, you know, which are the active ingredients, isolating the active ingredients, determining proper dosages, you know, which you can't do with most cannabis products. You know, you sort of just take some and, you know, if one gummy doesn't work, you take another one.
Mm.
The dosages are very inconsistent. You need those dosages and the studies on side effects to make drugs as safe as possible.
Mm.
So yeah, that's you know, you mentioned the profit motive. It's always weird for me that the alternative health industry has this fixation on the perfidiousness of the pharmaceutical industry and the evil of the profit motive, and that they won't give people these drugs because they can't figure out a way to make money out of them. Well, you know, these are the same companies that give you paracetamol for 5 cents a dose.
Yeah.
You know, they're not making a fortune out of paracetamol.
Mm-hmm.
You can get no-name paracetamol at the chemist for, I don't know, 25 rand or something for 100 pills. So the notion that they don't know how to make money off this is nonsense. You know, aspirin is derived from the bark of a willow tree. They, you know, that's a herbal remedy that's been proven to work. And what's weird is that they think that the corrupting influence of the profit motive mm. in the pharmaceutical industry doesn't apply to the alternative health industry.
Mm.
I mean, just the CBD industry alone was worth $3 billion in 2021 and is expected to be worth $60 billion by 2030.
Mm.
You know, that's a lot of money and a lot of money to corrupt you
mm.
and a lot of reasons to be selling snake oil.
Mm. Mm. Well, it's I think the problem as well is the fact that drug policy or the legalization of drugs is so fraught, and it's fraught because it is so difficult to get right, whether you fight it, whether you allow it, how you allow it, etc. How you legislate it is a huge, huge political issue. And the effects that you talk about, particularly in youngsters, possible psychosis and effect on brain function. So these issues should be weighed up and have to be weighed up in making a decision. I mean, there's a strong feeling on one side of the debate that dacha is a gateway drug, that it for some, if not a fair number of people, it leads to using other much more serious drugs. And you know, that debate is in the mix. It's very, very, it's complex. It is not that simple. And I think, you know, obviously issues like the opioid crisis in the States, which is now moving into the UK, and the Sackler family and everything one knows about it, it's horrific and it's very dramatic. But to take that as the only measure by which you judge the pharmaceutical, or it supports your prejudices about the pharmaceutical industry is very worrying, because at the same time, and just your thoughts on this, is the pharmaceutical industry is subject to regulation by government. Things have to be approved by government agencies. And one of the things that is impressive is was coming across this woman, Frances Oldham Kelsey, who was a member, an employee of the FDA in America, which authorizes or does not authorize the production of drugs. And she, in the early 60s, she refused to register thalidomide, which had been used in the UK and produced as infamous defects, birth defects that we know about. You can't hear the word thalidomide without associating them with a terrible period. And she refused to register them, despite pressure from the government, despite pressure from the industry, and will have saved possibly hundreds of thousands, if not millions of lives as a result, and the tragedy that would have gone with it. So at least that oversight, provided you don't succumb to, you know, perhaps a greedy industry or the lobbying effects on lawmakers in a government, at least are there. And 99% of the time, the drugs we get come out of the fact that regulation is available. Not in this industry, not in CBD.
You know, one of the telling things is that everyone knows the name thalidomide. Mm. Very few people know that it is actually still a registered drug, still on the market, for very specific uses in cancer treatment. They remember thalidomide, although it was taken off the market 63 years ago this year, you know, after causing these birth defects and so on. It was obviously an inadequately tested drug. It should never have been prescribed to pregnant women. And it's a great travesty, a great tragedy what happened there. Mm. But people remember thalidomide because it is so uncommon that these things happen. Mm. You know, they have to dig out something from 63 years ago to say, oh, but the pharmaceutical industry is bad. Mm. Or Vioxx is the other one, you know, that people remember by name. You know, this happened now more than 20 years ago, a drug company wasn't upfront about the heart conditions that it could affect. You know, so there were a very small number of heart attacks that were attributed to the use of Vioxx, which was a painkiller. Mm. And you know, that's of course that's too high a number for regulators, and that should have been disclosed, and it wasn't. So they had to take that off the market. But people remember these cases not because they're so common, but because they're so rare. Mm.
Just to say, I was heartbroken is a bit too strong a word, but I was heartbroken when Vioxx was taken off the market because it was effective. But you're not going to argue about the rigidity of regulation when it comes to the possible effect on health. But we'll pick that up in a moment. Okay, we'll pick that up in a moment.
Hashtag you don't have to be Jewish.
Ava, you want to tackle me on my comment about strict regulation?
Yeah, there's two things I wanted to say. The strict regulation issue is there's a debate to be had about what the public's risk tolerance really is. And I actually addressed that in a column I wrote yesterday on Boeing. You know, aircraft safety regulation, which is a very similar thing. Flying is at least 100 times safer than any other form of transport, right? Mm. The next safest is actually buses, funny enough, followed by trains. And then the vastly more unsafe is something like 50,000 times more unsafe than flying is personal motor vehicles, you know, passenger vehicles. Yet people take their own cars, and they are pedestrians, and they take bicycles and motorbikes all the time. They feel that this risk is worth taking. So it's sometimes questionable whether the regulatory insistence on perfect safety does really comport with the public's own subjective feeling of what their risk tolerance is. Noting that safety regulations always increase costs. Right? They always increase prices. In the case of the airlines that I was discussing, flying is out of the reach of most people. It's only the rich, the well-off, certainly the middle classes and up that can afford to fly, in part because the safety regulations are so incredibly strict. So there's an argument to be made with drug regulation that you have the same sort of problem, that people would actually be willing to take some more risks to get some drugs to market quicker. That they, while they're spending all this time making sure that the drug doesn't cause 1 in a million heart attacks, there are people dying of cancer that need the drug. So how many people are you going to kill by not licensing the drug, by continuing the testing and whatnot, before you license it, just to make sure. So there's a question whether whether regulation in the pharmaceutical industry and in any other sort of safety industry matches what the ultimate customer's risk profile really is. And I think very often regulators err on the side of safety. And that sometimes has negative consequences, including higher prices and sometimes delays in things like drug licensing that actually cause deaths. The other thing I wanted to mention is, we're talking about the reputation of the pharmaceutical industry, and it's often mentioned, opioids are often mentioned, antibiotics are often mentioned, antibiotic resistance, that this is now the result of this evil pharmaceutical company. I have yet to meet a doctor that will gladly prescribe antibiotics. Right? Most doctors that I've met, they will prescribe antibiotics if you ask, if you demand it. Right? But they'll say, oh, no, it's a virus. Don't worry about it. Come back to me next week if you're not better. And if then there's a secondary infection, then they might prescribe antibiotics. But they won't use it as a first line of defense. What's happened, though, especially in the USA, which is a very litigious society, is that people sue doctors for malpractice for all sorts of reasons. And if the doctors don't prescribe heavily in terms of painkillers, in terms of antibiotics and so on, if they don't cover their asses that way, they open themselves up to lawsuits from disgruntled patients. Or they lose customers, because if you don't prescribe the opioids, then the guy next door will, So now you've lost a patient and you've lost business. So there are reasons in the structure of the industry and in the legal industry, reasons that can actually be blamed not on the doctors or the pharmaceutical industry, but on the patients themselves, why the opioid crisis happened and why antibiotic resistance happened. It's because people walk into doctor's offices and they say, listen, doctor, this is what's wrong with me, and I want this and this drug. Would you please write a script? And the doctor sits there going, well, why the hell did I go to medical school? So there are a lot of reasons why these things happen. And I think blaming, picking on the pharmaceutical industry for this, I think is misplacing a lot of the blame. It's not really fully analyzing the problem.
Yeah. No, I think that's exactly right. And I think to bring back to the beginning of the discussion, essentially what we're saying is those of us who support the pharmaceutical industry as a whole would not for a moment stop people from taking whatever they think they would like to take or whatever effect they may anecdotally benefit from, but the reality is, in the sophistication of modern medicine, anecdote is not fact, anecdote is not proof, and anecdote is not thorough trial testing. And what we're really saying is, do not, you know, it's one thing to support an industry that has not proven its claims, and it's another thing to trash an industry that has to and does.
Yes, I entirely agree. You know, there's a great line that the Australian comedian Tim Minchin came out with years ago. He said, medicine has been proven to work. Right? Alternative medicine has not been proven to work. Alternative medicine that has been proven to work is called medicine.
That's exactly right.
You know, and this is just something to be aware of. You know, I mean, you can buy all the CBD products you like. I mean, I don't care what lotion you buy to put on your skin, or, you know, you can do whatever you like, but be skeptical, be even more skeptical of these alternative health remedies than you would be of conventional medicine. A lot of the claims, and that goes for a lot of other things too, you know, and it's not just CBD. It also goes for a lot of anti-aging creams and that sort of stuff. Be skeptical of these claims, because a lot of them haven't been proven, or they have very weak evidence behind them. You know, there was a study done, the study that I mentioned that says CBD doesn't work. There were 16 randomized controlled trials done. 15 of them showed no effect. The other one did. Right. But that is very weak evidence, and that is probably down to chance, you know, if you've got one outlier like that. Mm. So very weak evidence. So all the CBD sellers will use that one trial and say, look, it worked. Meanwhile, that is actually a statistical outlier that doesn't prove very much and offers very, very weak evidence. So just be aware of what you buy. You know, caveat emptor.
Let the buyer beware.
You know, let the buyer beware. Buy whatever you like. It's up to you. You know, I'm not going to say that the government should outlaw this stuff, but just be aware that don't be more gullible with the alternative health industry than you would be with the pharmaceutical industry.
Mm. On that note, and I think it's a matter of common sense applying, Ava, thank you very much for joining us and delving into an issue that gets a lot of emotion going, but not often a lot of clarity. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for the invitation, Sarah.